Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes for a good national security advisor? Former Marine Corps General James L. Jones and President Obama are forging their working relationship at a time of unprecedented challenges to the security of the United States, from not only foreign and potential terrorist adversaries, but from a chaotic economy and global climate change. So will they be personally as well as professionally close? Will Jones likely play a public role like Henry Kissinger in the Nixon White House, or work quietly but effectively behind the scenes like Brent Scowcroft, who served the first President Bush? Joining us with some keen insight is I.M. Dessler, who is professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. He and his co-author Ivo Dalder have just published a new book called In the Shadow of the Oval Office, Profiles of the National Security Advisors and the Presidents They Served, from JFK to George W. Bush. Mac, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Let's begin with this, because it makes sense to start here. What is the primary function of the National Security Advisor?
Well, people would informally say the function is to do whatever the president wants him or her to do. More practically, it is to support the president on foreign policy and to try to keep the government together and moving in the policy directions that the president desires.
And that doesn't necessarily mean not pushing back occasionally.
No, that should include pushing back. In fact, one of the criticisms of George W. Bush's first national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, was that perhaps she should have pushed back a little bit, at least on Iraq policy, at least to insist that options be reviewed before the president decided to go to war.
Mm-hmm. Now, the National Security Advisor reports only to the president and is not confirmed by Congress.
That is correct.
Is that to give the NSA a particular kind of freedom?
Certainly from the point of view of the president, that is correct. I mean, traditionally, it used to be that no presidential aides or assistants were confirmed by Congress. Now some are. The director of the Office of Management Budget is confirmed, for example. The president's science advisor is confirmed by Congress. So it's a mixed picture. But the argument for the National Security Advisor is that he or she should be free to advise the president and not be responsible to Congress, and therefore not be a public foreign policy leader.
What kinds of backgrounds have the National Security Advisors tended to come from over the years?
Well, a number have come from academic backgrounds, particularly in the early years of the FOS. The first National Security Advisor was McGeorge Bundy, who had been dean of the faculty at Harvard. More famously, Henry Kissinger, then noted international relations expert at Harvard, was Richard Nixon's national security advisor. Zbigniew Brzezinski advised President Carter. So early on in the first 20 years of the visible national security advisor, you had these strong academics playing the role. More recently, it's been more of a mix. You've had some academics like Condoleezza Rice under George W. Bush. You also had people who are had military backgrounds and were more inside players, like Brent Scowcroft under the first President Bush and, of course, General Jones.
Mm-hmm. And by law, who is on the National Security Council?
There have been for a long time essentially four official members of the National Security Council, which is the highest level committee in the United States government: President, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of the Defense. And recently, while none of us were looking, somebody snuck in a law that the Secretary of Energy should be a statutory member of the National Security Council. So now that there are officially five.
Mm-hmm. The position was originally, and you mentioned this earlier, created by John F. Kennedy, went to McGeorge Bundy. What was the feeling for the need to create this new position that had not existed in the past?
Well, the position actually existed under Dwight Eisenhower, who created it for a very specific purpose, which was to organize an elaborate policy planning process to decide what overall the United States should be doing toward the world and what its policies toward specific countries should be. And they did a huge amount of planning work. Kennedy thought this wasn't very useful. He thought that in specific situations you had to throw away the plans and just deal with the circumstances of the moment. And so he used the position, but he used it in a totally different way. He used it to support him in his day-to-day decisions, which Eisenhower had not done. And therefore, that's why we begin our book with Bundy and Kennedy, because that's what we call the modern national security advisor began there. And Kennedy didn't entirely know what he wanted, except he wanted to get a range of views. He wanted somebody to oversee and to encourage this flow of information to him. He wanted somebody to communicate his decisions to the rest of the government. And when there was a really difficult and tough decision, as of course Kennedy faced during the Cuban Missile Crisis of the fall of 1962, when the Russians surprisingly placed missiles in Cuba, he wanted a very closely held but broadly participatory process that gave a thorough vetting to all of the options, and Bundy was important in helping manage that process.
Yeah, and in fact, he and Kennedy had a close relationship.
That's right, absolutely. They had a kind of a distant relationship of mutual respect before Kennedy became president, but their policy relationship became very close rather quickly once Bundy was, particularly when Bundy moved his office into the White House proper.
His vision did sort of run counter fairly often to then Secretary of State Dean Rusk. Can you talk about the kinds of disagreements that they had?
Well, with Bundy and Rusk, it was not so much policy disagreements as a sort of a really fundamental incongruence of style. Rusk was a very formal person, committed to hierarchy, feeling that as Secretary of State, he shouldn't have to sort of be in the same room arguing with all of these people who didn't have any responsibility, as he said. Bundy was a sort of a fluid intellectual person, quite comfortable with lots of give and take, and Kennedy was really liked the Bundy style. He liked to have debate. He didn't want to be bored, but he liked the debate. He liked the flow and conflict of ideas in front of him. And so it wasn't so much that Rusk and Bundy disagreed on substance. You had that happening in a big way under Jimmy Carter when you had Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor, disagreeing on a broad range of issues. But in the early period, it was more a question of style and the fact that the president wanted a more fluid system. Bundy organized that, and Rusk was uncomfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. Bundy did not work as well with President Johnson as he had with President
Kennedy. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how the relationship sort of deteriorated there? Was it, again, a sort of a style issue?
Well, it was importantly a style issue. Bundy was an elitist, really. He was a Boston Brahmin. He was came up, and he was very articulate. He was he didn't suffer fools gladly. Now, of course, Lyndon Johnson was no fool. Lyndon Johnson was very, very smart, but he always was anxious in the presence of people who had come up from this different class background, whereas Johnson had come, of course, from a more rural background and not gone to the best schools. He once bragged that he was the only person in the room who went to Southeast Texas State Teachers College. And so there was some discomfort in the relationship. I think Bundy felt that Johnson was more difficult to deal with. You had to deal with his personality, whereas Kennedy was pretty straight on dealing with substance. And Johnson felt at times that Bundy didn't really fully respect him, that Bundy wasn't sufficiently loyal to him, sufficiently subordinate to him. And then the issue really broke out when Bundy supported expanding the war in Vietnam to his later extreme regret, but he felt that the president ought to go public and make very strong public arguments for it. Johnson was reluctant to do that because he wanted to keep congressional support for his domestic programs as long as possible, and he thought if he advertised a war, that people would stop supporting the domestic programs in Congress. So Bundy then accepted an invitation to debate Hans Morgenthau, a leading international scholar who opposed the war. And he did this knowing that Johnson didn't want him to. And this sort of led to almost a break between them. Johnson talked about firing Bundy, and Bundy decided it was time to look elsewhere, and the Ford Foundation offered him his presidency, so he went elsewhere.
Moving into the Nixon years, as always, Henry Kissinger is a fascinating figure, and no less so in this book. Can you talk about his style and how it gelled with Richard Nixon's, for better or for worse?
Certainly. Kissinger had a very different style from Bundy. Bundy had a very open style. Bundy would put down people who weren't quite smart enough, but anyone who was strong and articulate, Bundy would bring to the president. He would be sure the president heard the arguments, and he would therefore tend to expand the participation in the policy process. Kissinger was much more inclined to restrict it, to have things go through him, to try to limit access to the president. And more important, Richard Nixon wanted it that way. Richard Nixon, when he campaigned for office, said that he wanted an open National Security Council debate of the sort that President Eisenhower had had during his presidency. When Nixon became president, he found he didn't like that, that he felt put on the spot. He felt he didn't like it when people argued in front of him for action that he didn't want to take. And therefore, he found it more convenient simply to deal with a very small number of people who he became at least somewhat comfortable with. And Kissinger became the person for foreign policy. So increasingly, Nixon and Kissinger essentially made policy themselves and shut others out or gave others only bit roles in the process.
And their secrecy together and in partnership is, of course, legendary, to the extent that Kissinger was, in many cases, lying to his own staff about what he was working on.
Kissinger lied to people. He deceived people. He didn't. He just didn't let them know what was going on. He would keep them out of the top, the most important business. That's right. And he would do that. Do the same with the senior officials. Therefore, he was. This generated. On the one hand, it contributed to substantial accomplishments like the opening to China, which the Nixon administration inaugurated first time relations with the communist regime there. On the other hand,
let me stop you for just a second. There was a lot of sort of background work that Kissinger was able to accomplish secretly that he might not have been able to get away with had it been out there.
Well, yeah. In fact, what he said in his memoirs was that actually the departments made a lot of contributions, but they just didn't know they were making them. I mean, he would get staff work. They would have meetings lower down, and he would get the reports of the meetings. He would get the information, and he would use it. But what they wouldn't know was what was actually going on. I mean, there was a process, say, of opening relations carefully toward China, and the State Department participated, and certain steps were taken, and people in the State Department had no idea that Nixon and Kissinger were plotting a grand coup of, dramatically announcing that the president was going to visit China, as he did in triumph in 1972. But so the staff contributed, but they didn't know the basic. What was basically going on. Sometimes this was a big problem. In strategic arms agreements, Kissinger, by holding it close in dealings with the Soviet Union, he made some serious mistakes, which hurt the cause of arms control and I think made the position of the United States a little weaker than it should have been.
Did it also weaken things that Kissinger held on to the position of National Security Advisor even after he had accepted the post of Secretary of State?
Well, it certainly meant that you didn't have a strong monitor in the White House overseeing, countering, balancing what the Secretary of State could do. Now, for part of that period, of course, Richard Nixon was president, but in an excruciatingly weak position because he was increasingly besieged by all of the Watergate revelations of the scandal, which he had personally ordered to be covered up. And as that finally gradually became public, Nixon became weaker and weaker. He needed Kissinger so badly at that point that there was going to be no way you could really constrain him or check him in terms of power over foreign policy. It was in sharp contrast to earlier, where in the first term, Nixon really did call the shots, and Kissinger was very dependent on Nixon.
I.M. Dessler is my guest. His new book is called In the Shadow of the Oval Office, Profiles of the National Security Advisors and the Presidents They Served, from JFK to George W. Bush. We'll return in a moment. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is I.M. Dessler. He is professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. Along with Ivo Dalder, he has just published a book called In the Shadow of the Oval Office, Profiles of the National Security Advisors and the Presidents They Served from JFK to George W. Bush. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So you mentioned briefly earlier Zbigniew Brzezinski, who served under President Carter. He and Carter got along well. On the other hand, Brzezinski did not get along well with the Secretary of State at the time, Vance.
Well, they were increasingly in conflict. Carter and Brzezinski got along very well personally, and Brzezinski was very loyal to Carter, but his policy views were not that consistent with Carter's. He was much more hawkish, much more inclined to be confrontational, particularly vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, whereas Carter was much less inclined, much more peace-minded, as it were, and as his subsequent career made visible. Vance was somewhere in between, but closer to where Carter was, and what Vance found frustrating was that Brzezinski would go public and make statements that weren't necessarily reflective of the administration, and then the press would seize upon the differences and perhaps magnify them, and so quickly the administration developed a reputation for not having its house in order.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly that story illustrates the importance of the president in managing his own national security advisor.
Absolutely, and in managing his broader policy process, because the president is the dominant figure.
Ideally, should the National Security Advisor not be sort of seen and heard publicly?
I think history suggests the process works better if he is not. I think that Brent Scowcroft, Gerald Ford, and George H.W. Bush's National Security Advisor, he held the job twice. Brent said the National Security Advisor should be seldom seen and heard even less, something like that. And the idea being that he performs best if he is a trusted inside player, if he can be relied on by the president to convey the honest views of the other major advisors and be trusted by those major advisors to convey those views. He will be the person closest to the president. He has a White House office. He's down the hall, literally about 20 seconds away. And they are in other buildings. They may be in other continents. And he needs to be a reliable communications link. He needs to be sure that what the Secretary of State is doing during an overseas negotiation is something the president supports. If the secretary needs a decision, he needs to be able to get it. And he needs to be trusted by the secretary to be able to get that decision by presenting the secretary's best argument, by knowing when he needs to put the secretary on the phone directly with the president or when it can be conveyed indirectly. All of these things, details in how you manage it to maintain trust and to be sure that you really have a foreign policy team.
Now, the National Security Advisor was not just down the hall under Ronald Reagan. He sort of stripped, at least initially, a great deal of power from the position.
Well, initially, he sent him back to the White House basement, which is where actually McGeorge Bundy had operated from. And he did not, and his first National Security Advisor, Richard Allen, did not work directly for Reagan, but he worked through Edwin Meese, the counselor to the president, who had great broad policy power. And that did not work well, particularly because the Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, did not work well with the Reagan White House. He was very assertive. He seemed to be getting off the reservation. He was highlighting conflict internationally when the Reagan administration wanted all attention being paid to the president's economic policy. So you had kind of a mess in the first Reagan year, and they therefore brought in a stronger man closer to Reagan named William Clark, who moved back onto the first floor near the president, but had other problems. Clark didn't know much about foreign policy, was his biggest problem.
Which is extraordinary for a national security advisor.
Yes, yes. probably knew less about it than any other person to hold the position. The broader problem in the Reagan administration is that President Reagan didn't really want to make tough decisions between his, if he had to choose between his advisors, and he had chosen a Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, and Secretary of State, George Shultz, who replaced Haig, and Weinberger and Shultz didn't like each other. They had sharply different views about a whole range of policy issues, and these views tended to fester because Reagan wouldn't make decisions, and he wouldn't really empower his national security advisor to make those decisions. So you had a lot of festering conflict in that administration as well.
And then how did Frank Carlucci change the scope of the position?
Well, Frank Carlucci came after what is known as the Iran-Contra affair, or the Iran-Contra scandal, so named because the National Security Advisor, with the participation of the CIA director, William Casey, was involved in both selling arms to Iran, which we were not supposed to be doing, and using the funds to fund the revolutionaries seeking to overthrow the government of Nicaragua. And this was both a violation of U.S. law and a violation of declaratory U.S. policy against giving aid to countries that support terrorism. Essentially, what happened was President Reagan wanted something done about hostages that were being held in Iran. He wanted something done about the Contras in Nicaragua. And these White House aides decided the only way we can run policy because of this stalemate is to essentially do it secretly. And so they ran this operation with only Shultz and Weinberger having marginal knowledge of it. It's ironic because this was one issue where Weinberger and Shultz agreed. They agreed it was a terrible idea, shouldn't be done. And if they had actually been in communication with each other, they might have been able to stop it. But what happened was the whole thing became public. It was a great humiliation to Reagan. It almost destroyed his presidency. But Reagan brought in Frank Carlucci to repair the story. Carlucci said, "Why are you choosing me?" And Reagan said, "You're the only person that George Shultz and Cap Weinberger will agree on." But Carlucci was a seasoned professional. He replaced most of the staff, and he instituted an orderly policy process, which has, in form and in structure, continued to this day.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Ian Dessler. He's professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. His new book is called In the Shadow of the Oval Office, Profiles of the National Security Advisors and the Presidents They Served, from JFK to George W. Bush. Let's talk for a minute about George H.W. Bush. Brent Scowcroft, as you mentioned, had also held the position of National Security Advisor for Gerald Ford, but he seems to have really fully come into his own under the first President Bush.
That is very much true. Yeah, that is when Brent Scowcroft came into his own. Bit of background here. The United States recently has been inclined to elect outsider presidents with people with almost no or only limited Washington experience. The big exception was George H.W. Bush, who had served not only as vice president for 8 years under Ronald Reagan, but he had served as CIA director, ambassador to China, congressman, chairman of the Republican Party, had all sorts of inside roles. And he had, during the Ford administration, when Bush was CIA director, he had worked harmoniously with Brent Scowcroft, who was then National Security Advisor. So when Bush becomes president, he, unlike most recent presidents, has personal knowledge of and relationships with a number of people who have served in these high-level positions. And he thought Scowcroft did an excellent job under Ford, and he decided Scowcroft should do that under him.
And how much influence did, I mean, obviously Scowcroft did an exceptional job under President George H.W. Bush, and then Bush sort of managed him effectively as well.
Well, I think that's right. Well, first of all, Bush was a relatively collegial president. He had as his Secretary of State his best friend, a very strong man, James Baker, and who had been Bush's campaign manager, and Baker was the first appointee that Bush made for his new administration after he won the 1988 election. And so Scowcroft began essentially very quietly, and he's explained it to us when we had an oral history roundtable and talked to several national security advisors on the record. And Brent said, the first thing you have to do is establish trust. You have to spend your first year at least working with the senior players, meeting with them formally, meeting with them informally, demonstrating that you will communicate their views accurately to the president, developing below you a committee of deputies that will support you and run a lot of the day-to-day operations because the top people are too busy. Generally speaking, have an orderly and trusted foreign policy process. And Brent did this for President Bush. And then when Bush was confronted with his most direct foreign policy challenge, Saddam Hussein's invasion of and conquest of Kuwait in the summer of 1990, Brent was in a position to push his own particular point of view, which in this particular case was the most hawkish, the most determined to respond, if necessary, with military force of anybody in the administration, including, at least initially, President Bush. And Scowcroft did so. He asked the president if it was all right for him to present this view. The president encouraged him to do so. And people took this. Unlike when Brzezinski presented views with Carter, people thought that he was distorting the process. But because Brent had previously established this trust, it worked for him to do this. And even though he was much more inclined to resort to military action than, say, James Baker, they actually worked together, and Baker did a wonderful job of building up a coalition of support, both military and financial, for the operation, and it was a great policy success, at least in terms of driving the Iraqis out of Kuwait.
You know, this idea that, according to Scowcroft, it takes the first year to sort of build trust seems almost hazardous in a job where you really are only guaranteed 4 years to get the job done.
Well, presumably you're making policy as you are establishing trust. But, of course, that's the nature of our government, is because we bring in a bunch of people typically who have not worked with one another before. So they have to feel each other out. They have to find what roles they are comfortable with. They have to find out how to deal with each other. And the president has to learn how to be president.
How well did Bill Clinton and Anthony Lake function as a team?
Well, they functioned pretty well, and better in the second part of the administration of the first term than the first part. Lake had advised Clinton in the presidential campaign, and Clinton respected him. Clinton was closer to Lake's deputy, Sandy Berger, who had been with him longer and who had much more of a kind of a common, substantive, and political approach to issues. Tony was a little less close to Clinton, but Berger thought that Clinton should choose Lake because Lake had more experience and Lake had been Berger's boss before. So Lake came in. Then Clinton wanted to put foreign policy to the side, deal with the economy, deal with other issues. But there was no and Lake, who had worked for Henry Kissinger and worked in the State Department during Brzezinski's period in the White House, felt that the National Security Advisor had been too strong, too dominating, had messed up the process in previous administrations, and he was determined not to do that. So he started out playing a very low-key role. The problem was that Warren Christopher was not in a position to or able to lead across the board as Secretary of State. First Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin, didn't turn out to be effective as Secretary of Defense, and so you had a sort of a leader, a president who wanted his subordinates to lead, and they didn't lead very well, and so you had kind of a stalemate and some real policy fiascos early on, symbolized by Somalia, where much of U.S. Rangers were killed in an ambush, and the administration didn't seem to have a good explanation for exactly why they were there and what they were doing. But Lake then became more assertive, and he helped turn around policy toward Bosnia, making it possible for Richard Holbrooke to negotiate the famous Dayton Accords later in that year, which brought peace to that area. Tony also got involved in stabilizing relations with China, which had been a problem in the early Clinton administration. And so he caught on and was much more effective when he became more assertive. But unlike, say, Kissinger, he didn't exclude people. He included people. He told Christopher what he was doing. They had meetings and everything like this, but he just pushed his own views more.
Moving into the administration of the second President Bush, Condoleezza Rice is viewed in many different circles to have really failed, at least when she was serving as National Security Advisor. Can you talk about who and what was working against her?
Condoleezza Rice had, I think, three people working against her. first and perhaps maybe most publicized, Secretary of Defense, obviously a major player, particularly if you're going to be going to war, didn't respect her, didn't want her to play a role, sometimes wouldn't return her telephone calls. There's one famous incident in the White House where she was handed a briefing book, and at the end of the meeting, he grabbed it away from her and said, "You don't need that," and he took it back to the Pentagon, and she had to get a bootlegged copy through some back channel maneuvers in order to keep on top of what was going on. So Rumsfeld had a very strong ally in the White House. He'd long been associated with Dick Cheney, then the vice president. And Cheney himself, of course, played an outsized role for a vice president in foreign policy. Cheney actually wanted to be the director for foreign policy formally. He asked Bush if T. Cheney could chair what's called the Principals Committee, a job normally given to the National Security Advisor. Rice protested, and Bush said, no, Condi will chair this committee. But Cheney always had the option of going directly to the president, so there was no confidence that the Rice channel to the president was the one that really counted so far as the policy process. And then the final problem that Condi Rice had was the president. He was on the one hand, he was close to her substantively. She did a wonderful job of briefing him. She was a very articulate spokesperson explaining what the president's policy was, what the arguments were. But he decided things quickly. He didn't want them to be reviewed. He didn't encourage them. And so on Iraq, for example, he seems to have decided, perhaps even by the end of 2001, certainly by the summer of 2002, that he was very strongly inclined toward a military solution. Now, a national security advisor should have insisted that there be a serious policy review and high-level policy debate, with arguments pro and con be brought before the president, both in paper and in the form of individuals making these arguments. And if encouraged, Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, would certainly have made a number of the cautionary arguments, which he did a couple of times fairly carefully with George W. Bush. But the president didn't want this, and so she didn't do it. And as a result, we had a remarkable thing of a country going to war without a single high-level meeting discussing seriously whether or not it was a good idea.
I.M. Dessler is my guest. He's professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. His new book is called In the Shadow of the Oval Office, Profiles of the National Security Advisors and the Presidents They Served, from JFK to George W. Bush. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, look a little bit at the Obama administration. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with I.M. Dessler, co-author of the new book, In the Shadow of the Oval Office, Profiles of the National Security Advisors and the Presidents They Served, from JFK to George W. Bush. If you want to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. I want to go back for just a moment, Mac, to the analysis of Condoleezza Rice in the Bush administration.
Sure.
Is it your sense that she ultimately redeemed herself as Secretary of State?
Well, I think she did a better job as Secretary of State. I don't know if we can point to major diplomatic accomplishments. But interestingly, she did reverse some policies. In fact, in the second, whereas the first Bush administration, first term of George W. Bush, showed a great reluctance to engage in diplomacy, a tendency to feel the United States should take action and those who were with us would follow us, and that was good, and those who weren't were enemies. The second Bush administration was actually more conciliatory, more inclined to negotiate. One dramatic example was with relations with North Korea, where we achieved some progress in terms of limiting North Korean nuclear development after the first term had essentially thrown away a Clinton agreement and made it possible for the North Koreans to refine a lot of nuclear material and build several bombs. And so there was some movement in the second administration. She was also had a more confident position. Cheney was weaker. His foreign policy aide, Scooter Libby, was under indictment and eventually convicted. The Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld, was much weaker in the second term, even before he was fired by the president after the 2006 elections. And Condi Rice, while she didn't have all the skills and all the initial respect around the world that Colin Powell, as secretary, had, she had one thing that Colin Powell did not have, which was the strong trust and confidence of the president. And that is something a secretary of state badly needs.
So do you think ultimately her success as Secretary of State had as much to do with other sort of personnel changes within the White House as it did with her suitability for the position?
Well, I think it certainly had to do with personal changes elsewhere. I mean, also the fact that she had backstopping her, working with her in the White House, Steve Hadley, who had been her deputy when she was National Security Advisor in the first administration, that was helpful to her. So she didn't have a rival in the White House. I think it was also the other potential rivals were weaker, but I think her relationship with the president and her she has a lot. She's a highly competent individual with a lot of understanding, a lot of skills that are relevant to the conduct of foreign policy, and I think she was in a better position to employ those skills as Secretary of State.
So President Obama did not choose an academic as his national security advisor. He has James L. Jones, a former Marine.
That's correct.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about their relationship as we understand it right now?
Well, I'm not sure how much we understand it yet. I mean, I'm sure there are others who understand it better than I because I'm not in the White House. Obama, we can say that Obama didn't know Jones very well. They had had only two or three conversations, apparently. He respected him. He, I think, thought that Jones was the type of individual, a man of integrity, somebody who would run a balanced and fair policy process. And it's interesting because Obama did not choose one of several people he might have chosen who had much closer relations with him in the policy sense or had been major policy advisors to him in the campaign. So this means that Obama and Jones have to build their relationship on the job. Now, that's not unique. Kissinger hardly knew Nixon before Nixon chose him. Bundy didn't know Kennedy all that well before they came together. So it's quite quite possible to do this, but it's something that needs to be, in a sense, constructed on the job. And there are a couple of possible problems. One is that there are several people formally working for Jones as deputies on the National Security Council staff who have longer-standing relations with President Obama than Jones does. And in a couple of cases, people who worked for him in the Senate were important policy aides to him whose advice, substantive advice, Obama values. And there's nothing wrong with Obama talking to other people on the NSC staff other than the head of it, the National Security Advisor, but the advisor has to somehow stay on top of that. He has to be basically in the flow. He has to know what's going on. He has to be the first among equals. Otherwise, it's very hard for him to do an effective policy management job.
So why do you think he chose Jones?
I suppose there were several reasons. I think he may have felt that he wanted somebody. He may have thought of Brent Scowcroft, who apparently has been doing some advising to Obama, and thought that I wanted maybe a military man of integrity who had been resistant to the Pentagon under Donald Rumsfeld might be a good person, might be a good choice. I think he was trying to establish himself with the military in interesting ways by choosing people who had been military dissenters to some degree under George W. Bush. The other dramatic choice, of course, was General Shinseki as Secretary for Veterans Affairs. Mm-hmm. Shinseki, who had said that we would need several hundred thousand troops to win in Iraq and who was essentially dismissed. So I think that he was trying to sort of build support among the military. And I think also Obama, in some fundamental way, thinks of himself as running his own policy process. he's brought in lots of high-powered aides, and they tend to be people, often they're not people who are known for running a policy process. Larry Summers, the chief economic advisor, John Holdren, the chief science advisor, new environment and energy advisor. There's just a whole bunch of people who are very strong personalities with strong substantive views who don't. I think the president himself probably thinks that he is the one who will listen to them. He is the one who will make the decisions. And the question is, can he balance all that himself?
There is currently a 60-day review underway to study whether the Homeland Security Council should fold into the control of the National Security Advisor.
That's right.
Does that integration make sense to you?
Well, there are a couple of ways it makes sense and a couple of ways in which it causes problems. The basic sense of it is that the Homeland Security problem is a combination of domestic and international concerns. Obviously, it's domestic in the sense that you want to prevent attacks and you need, police, you need activity by the FBI, et cetera, to know what people are doing within the United States if you want to avoid things like a replication of 9/11. It's international in the sense that that's where the animus comes, that's where the motivation comes, that's where the people are likely to come from. That's where horror of horrors, if somebody smuggled a weapon of mass destruction in, where that would come from. And so you have so clearly there is a problem of coordinating domestic and international issues, and the NSC is a better place than anywhere else to do it. The concerns are two. One is the question of how much did the NSC get into activities within the United States. So there was a traditional resistance to this, particularly when, after the Cold, in the middle of the Cold War, people learned that the CIA and other institutions had been using powers that were supposed to be for surveillance of foreigners to use to surveil Americans as well or infiltrate American institutions. And so people tried to draw lines between the national security institutions, which are supposed to operate and focus mainly overseas, and other institutions like the FBI, which would do domestic security. And with the, if you bring the Homeland Security Office and the NSC, that obviously crosses that line, which has problems, but at the same time, it leads to more effective integration in preparing for countering attacks. The other problem is simply that you probably add maybe 30 more people to a National Security Council staff that already, even though the Obama people reduced it somewhat, already has sort of on the order of 80 people or so. So you get over 100 early in administration. It tends to grow. And this is awfully large for a policy staff and is likely to cause problems because not very many people on the staff will really know what the president wants or have contact with the president. Not many of them will have effective contact with Jones. And so if the staff becomes a bureaucracy like the permanent government, it's less responsive, less fluid, less able to serve the president in a direct and efficient way.
Do you have the sense that Jones is all that interested in staying under the radar in the manner of Brent Scowcroft?
That's a good question. He has done a couple of things that were not under the radar. He flew off to Munich and he spoke at the Munich International Security Conference early in the administration. He spoke on the record. He spoke mainly on the plans for structure of the national security process, not on policy substance. He at one point flew down to Florida to greet the King of Spain, sort of a job that would not normally be something, so I don't know that he wants to be a prominent policy spokesman. I haven't seen that. On the other hand, I'm not sure whether he wants to be a totally invisible figure either.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that he really wants to do with the NSC is to make sure that he is fully on top of things that weren't traditionally considered to be security issues, things
right.
like climate change and energy and cybersecurity and even infrastructure. Will you talk about how that might change the nature of the job in the Obama administration?
Well, one thing he would do, if he in fact gets into climate issues, if he in fact gets into a range of these issues, he would, of course, bump heads with other White House staff people whose jobs are to coordinate these issues. Traditionally, the NSC has had this very broad jurisdiction. In fact, the original law says it's supposed to do international security, defense, diplomacy, economics, and domestic policy. So it's the legal mandate is to kind of do anything that affects the national security. Traditionally, it is focused predominantly on the political military questions, on diplomacy or on use of the military or deployment of the military, such that presidents have found the need to establish separate channels and separate institutions for international economic policy, for example. Now, the new executive order, which has been emphasized by Jones in his conversation with Washington Post reporter Karen DeYoung, is something that actually doesn't go that much beyond what the George W. Bush administration did in their executive order. George W. Bush administration executive order had a similar broad scope, but in practice, their national security process was more the traditional limits of the main players being the White House, the Defense Department, the Secretary of State, the intelligence agencies. So whether this will in fact turn out to be different, we will have to see.
Do you think it's possible that those traditional definitions are in fact, or as they're practiced, are in fact too narrow for the way the world is?
They are too narrow. There's no question about it. And of course you have a CIA, who was the director National Intelligence, saying that the biggest security threat to the United States is the pressures on vulnerable governments caused by the international economic crisis. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have a huge, an erasure of these lines. The problem is the government is still structured across these lines, and while one of the potential virtues of a White House staff is to reach across them, they still have to deal with institutions that have these limited mandates. And so the tendency has been for the national security people to deal with the national security community and the economic people to deal with the people who do international trade, international finance, things like that, and for these issues to only meet at the presidency. Now, this administration has done a staffing arrangement where you have a senior official, a deputy assistant to the president named Froman, who works both for Jones and for Larry Summers. So he's supposed to coordinate international economic policy and work with both of them. Bush administration had a similar official, and this is a useful way to try to connect them. And they'll probably make some success in connecting them, but it's very hard to do.
The last thing I want to ask you very briefly, people talk a lot about the first 100 days. How long do you like to wait before you start to evaluate the effectiveness of a particular administration?
Well, I think the effectiveness, there's no obvious time, but you can ask questions. You can look at patterns. One question I would ask before we finish is, Jones comes out of a hierarchical organizational tradition. Obama comes out of a very different one, much more fluid, much more like, I think Obama's a lot like Kennedy in that regard as a president. And therefore, there's a real question as to whether Jones can adapt his mode of operation to be consonant with the way Obama likes to operate.
Mac, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
The new book is In the Shadow of the Oval Office. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think